Chapter 3. They camped that night in the mouth of the pass, with the mountains standing up before them. They had pushed the pace all that afternoon, and the horses were tired. They turned their tails to the wind and cropped the dry winter grass. Emby Janey built a fire in the shelter of a red stone outcrop, and they huddled beside it, brewing coffee, trying to keep out of the snow-cold wind. But it came down off the mountains and blew a plume of sparks from the fire. They ate. Then Emby Janey curled up beside the fire, pulled his caross over his head, and didn't move again until morning. "How far is it to this place?" Sean asked.
"I don't know," Duff admitted. "We'll go up through the pass tomorrow, 50 or 60 miles through the mountains, and then we'll be out into the high veldt. Perhaps another week's riding after that."
"Are we chasing rainbows?" Sean poured more coffee into the mugs.
"I'll tell you when we get there."
Duff picked up his mug and cupped his hands around it. "One thing's certain, that sample was stinking with gold. If there's much of that stuff around, somebody's going to get rich."
"Us, perhaps?"
"I've been on gold stampedes before. The first ones in make the killings. We might find the ground for 50 miles around as thick with claim pegs as quills on a porcupine's back."
Duff sipped noisily at his coffee.
"But we've got money. That's our ace in the hole. If we peg a proposition, we've got capital to work it. If we're too late, we can buy claims from the brokers. If we can't, well, there are other ways of getting gold than grubbing for it. A store, a saloon, a transport business. Take your pick."
Duff flicked the coffee grounds out of his mug.
"With money in your pocket, you're somebody. Without it, anyone can kick you in the teeth."
He took a long black cheroot out of his top pocket and offered it to Sean. Sean shook his head, and Duff bit the tip from the cheroot and spat it into the fire. He picked up a burning twig and lit it, sucking with content.
"Where did you learn mining, Duff?"
"Canada."
The wind whipped the smoke away from his mouth as Duff exhaled.
"You've been around."
"I have, laddie. It's too damn cold to sleep. We'll talk instead.
For a guinea, I'll tell you the story of my life."
"Tell me first. I'll see if it's worth it."
Sean pulled the blanket up round his shoulders and waited.
"Your credit's good," agreed Duff.
He paused dramatically.
"I was born 31 years ago, fourth and youngest son to the 16th Baron Roxby. That is, not counting the others who never made it to puberty."
"Blue blood," said Sean.
"Of course, just look at my nose, but please don't interrupt. Very early in the game, my father, the 16th Baron, dispelled with a horsewhip any natural affection we may have owed him. Like Henry VIII, he preferred children in the abstract. We kept out of his way, and that suited everybody admirably, a sort of armed truce. Dear father had two great passions in life, horses and women. During his 62 glorious years, he acquired a fine collection of both. My 15-year-old cousin, a comely wench, as I recall, was his last and unattained ambition. He took her riding every day and fingered her most outrageously as he helped her in and out of the saddle. She told me about it with giggles. However, father's horse, a commendably moral creature, cut short the pursuit by kicking father on the head, presumably in the middle of one of these touching scenes. Poor father was never the same again. In fact, so much was he altered by this experience that 2 days later, to the doleful clangor of bells and a collective sigh of relief from his sons and neighbours, who owned daughters, they buried him.
Dufford leaned forward and prodded the fire.
"It was all very sad.
I or any of my brothers could have told father that not only was my cousin comely, but she had the family's sporting instincts developed to a remarkable degree. After all, who should know better than we? We were her cousins, and you know how cousins will be cousins. Anyway, father never found out, and to this day I feel guilty. I should have told him. He would have died happier. Do I bore you? No, go on. I've had half a guinea's worth already, Sean laughed. Father's untimely decease made no miraculous changes in my life. The 17th Baron, Brother Tom, once he had the title, was every bit as tight-fisted and unpleasant as father had been. There I was, at 19, on an allowance too small to enable me to pursue the family hobbies, gathering mould in a grim old castle 40 miles from London, with the development of my sensitive soul being inhibited by the undiluted company of my barbaric brothers. I left with 3 months' advance allowance clutched in my sweaty palm, and the farewells of my brothers ringing in my ears. The most sentimental of these was, "Don't bother to write." Everybody was going to Canada. It seemed like a good idea, so I went too. I made money and spent it. I made women and spent them also. But the cold got to me in the end. Duff's cheroot had died. He relit it and looked at Sean. It was so cold you couldn't urinate without getting frostbite on your equipment. So I began to think of lands tropical, of white beaches and sun, of exotic fruits, and even more, exotic maidens. The peculiar circumstances that finally decided me to leave are painful to recall, and I will not dwell upon them. I left, to say the least, under a cloud. So here you see me, freezing slowly to death, with a bearded ruffian for company, and not an exotic maiden within a day's ride. A stirring tale, well told, applauded Sean. One story deserves another. Let's hear your tale of woe. Sean's smile slid off his face. Born and bred here in Natal, left home a week or so ago, also in painful circumstances. A woman? Asked Duff with deep compassion. A woman, agreed Sean. The sweet bitches, sighed Duff. How I love them.